Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Nearly 1 year after two bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, new information continues to emerge about the alleged bombers, and particularly about law enforcement's handling of information leading up to and following the attack. A review by the Obama administration released just yesterday raised new questions about what the government knew and what it should have known about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, one of the alleged bombers. Here's California Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, who sits on the House Committee on Homeland Security, speaking earlier this week.
Even though Boston is standing strong, it would be a disservice to the community not to take a look back. There are still unanswered questions about the history of the alleged Boston Marathon bombers, and we owe it to the people of Boston and the rest of America to make sure that the appropriate officials do a thorough review of that situation.
So what are those unanswered questions that the Congresswoman was talking about? What clues did the FBI miss about the alleged bomber prior to the attack? And what have we learned about the local law enforcement response? And what do we still need to know? There are other questions, and no doubt many of them can't be answered now, maybe ever. But we think it's important to at least put them on the table. So listeners, what's your question 1 year later? What still puzzles you about this terrible story? Do you think we have all the information that we should? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And we're joined now by two people who have been thinking a lot about this. Peter Canellos is a frequent guest on our program. He's the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony.
It's really good to have you. And Janet Reitman, contributor to Rolling Stone magazine. She wrote last year's feature on alleged marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev called Jahar's World. And Janet Reitman, a great pleasure to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter, I want to start close to home with you and talk about the local law enforcement response first. Just this week in Washington, members of the Watertown Police Force testified before the House Committee on Homeland Security. There was a lot of pride expressed, rightfully so. Lawmakers praised Chief Ed DeVoe and his officers. Former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis was there. And I think if you watched and listened to that hearing, the big takeaway was, hooray, they got the bad guys. There was a lot of heroism that week. No doubt there was, but questions remained unanswered or unexamined by officials with regard to the way law enforcement responded to that event a year ago. And I'm wondering what's on top of your list, questions that we should be examining.
Well, I think the biggest question is how to provide a command structure that can seamlessly oversee large numbers of police departments and potentially even fire departments, depending on the nature of the emergency, that might come together for a future event like this. And it may not be a terrorist attack. It may be a devastating weather event. It may be a plane crash. It may be something of that order, a fire that is just so overwhelming that, just like with this event, you're pulling in police officers from Western Massachusetts, from the transit police, from all, you know, it's sort of an all hands on deck kind of moment. We need to make sure that all of those people know who is in charge and where they're going to be getting their orders from. And we have to make sure they have equipment that talks to each other and complements each other. I see that as a big challenge and a big Homeland Security priority.
And Peter, and what did you see that day in terms of how these multiple jurisdictions and how they communicated and cooperated with each other?
Well, you know, I'm not the investigator here to say these things, but I would say that the questions that ought to be asked surrounding Watertown in particular were first of all the middle of the night shooting of the transit police officer in friendly fire. You know, how that came to be. Obviously, officials from one police department thought another police department may have been, one of the Tsarnaevs and shot and nearly killed one of their colleagues. That's something that requires a lot of probing. The question of the house-to-house search, how it was handled, how it was organized. I mean, we all saw the photos. There were an awful lot of law enforcement people that weren't searching. There were some who were searching. You know, were the resources used in an optimal manner? And who was in charge. When Tsarnaev, Zhahar Tsarnaev was found, there was a fusillade of bullets. Finally, Bill Evans, who's now the police commissioner, was able to assert control. But again, you had all these officers from different departments shooting an unarmed man at the time.
Yeah.
They didn't know that. We don't know what the protocols are. These are all questions that just need to be explored closely so that next time we can learn from them.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, when we talk about these multiple jurisdictions, we're talking about, I mean, just to be absolutely clear, what we're talking about, Watertown Police, Boston Police, Brookline Police, MBTA Police. I even saw a picture of a Boston University police officer involved in that search. There were SWAT teams from the state police. There were fish and game police from points north. I mean, it was quite an array of law enforcement officials. So your point is well taken, Peter. Janet, let me come to you, because Peter mentioned the capture of Zhahar Tsarnaev. As we know, he was hiding in a boat on Franklin Street in Watertown. And one of the big questions, how did he elude the massive manhunt with these thousands of officers? I mean, what do you make of that question?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think that's a great question. I think he... and I'm not a Bostonian. I'm a New Yorker, so I can't. I certainly can't answer that question, because I wasn't even in the state when this was happening. But so I watched it on television like everybody else. Mm. I have no idea. I think it's very interesting. I know that I did interview some people from the FBI, which is a little unusual. They don't normally do these kinds of interviews, but we did have a kind of background chat about that, the manhunt. And, yeah, you know, there were this like a sort of an FBI SWAT team that was brought in, and they were brought in like towards the end of this whole thing. And so, I think they were seemingly as surprised by my impression from the conversation I had was that they were surprised by the number of people that were out there. I mean, you had a small army.
Yeah.
I don't know how one 19-year-old kid eludes. I think that, you know, probably lack of, you know, coordination and organization.
And Janet, I want to ask you another question.
And just reaction. I mean, it seemed like people were terrified and they reacted. Why did they shut down? Why did they shut down Watertown? Why did that become like a militarized zone?
What other questions do you have about his capture? For example, the note that was supposedly written while he was hiding in the boat. What do we know about that?
Well, I mean, like, do you guys believe it? I'm not saying I don't believe it, but like, it's been taken at face value that, mm-hmm. that this kid who is you know, the story of Zhahar Tsarnaev was that he was in the same, you know, moment where his brother was shot. He was shot, and he escaped, having been shot. I believe it was in the leg, and he was bleeding. And you know, he runs, eludes capture. You know, he makes his way to this guy's backyard and crawls into his boat. He's bleeding. He's bleeding pretty profusely. And he lies there for like 18 hours. So, in the dark. And I guess he had a Sharpie in his pocket. I mean, I don't mean to make light of this, but like, he must have had a little, like a pen in his pocket that he decided to write this note that sounds to me like straight from, you know, the sort of, like the terrorist playbook,
right?
You know. I mean,
well, what do we know? What do we know, Janet, about the source? The source of this original story that he wrote this note.
Well, the source of this was John Miller, who's a former FBI spokesman. Then he became a reporter. Then he went back to the FBI. He's done this like three or four times. So I'm not sure where he is at right now. He was at CBS when this happened, and he is a he's very obviously very knowledgeable about law enforcement and very trusted by law enforcement. And so he was leaked this information, mm-hmm. and he then provided it to the rest of the media. And you have to understand, at this point in time, you know, people were like dying for any bit of information. It was really, I'm sure Peter can attest to this too, it's just really hard to know what was going on. You know, certainly the FBI and law enforcement was very close-mouthed about this. In any kind of objective way, unless they had something they specifically wanted to leak. But it was very hard to find out anything. And so here's this former spokesman, you know, now quite respected correspondent for CBS, who comes forth with this information. We don't have a photograph of this. We just have his word for it. We don't have, he was shown a photograph. He didn't even see it up close. He saw, I believe he saw somebody's cell phone photo of this. And this gets reported by everybody. So, you know, when I was reporting my piece, I had a tremendous number of questions about that, as I think any rational person honestly would.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, how it's middle of the night, you know, just so happens you have to have a pen in your pocket. You've written a manifesto on the inside of this boat while you're bleeding. It's not implausible. You know, I mean,
it's not implausible, it raises certainly a big question.
Convenient.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you also have to remember, then this was leaked, by the way, on the day that the FBI, it was either the day or within it, I think it was actually the day that the FBI was very greatly embarrassed by revelations that they had been, I think it was tapping the phones or reading the emails of some reporters at Fox News. So, you know, there was a lot of news about the FBI's surveillance of journalists during this period when this boat, all of a sudden, this boat note information comes out.
Right.
And, you know, it was like, look,
right.
we got the right guy, you know, look, we have information, we're like condemning him.
All right, Janet,
it just sort of shifted the spotlight a little bit. I just found it very convenient.
Yeah. I want to move on to a couple of other questions. And, Peter, let me come back to you because... you know, you raised some really interesting questions there about the local law enforcement response. Do you feel that there's been resistance to sort of examining these questions because of what, a desire to preserve the sort of justifiable sense that there was a lot of heroics that week as well?
Sensitive situation. It's somewhat analogous to some of these military situations mm-hmm. that we've seen recently where everybody feels a sense of gratitude towards the first responders that is similar to the sense of gratitude that people feel to members of the Army going into combat. I mean, these people are fighting for us, they're defending us, and they're doing a great job. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't pull back sometimes and look at the strategy behind the war. Is it working? Did every, you know, aspect of the mission go according to clockwork? It's just sort of normal procedures. It's something that every company does, everybody does. People do it in their personal lives, looking back to see how, at key moments things worked and didn't work.
Yeah.
And so I think that separating the two can be difficult in a very emotionally fraught situation. And I think that anybody who's in one of the law enforcement agencies, just like, you know, we all like to scrutinize ourselves and look into our own behavior. Having outside people do it makes you uncomfortable. That's understandable. And it may be that some of the people who, you know, don't want the investigation, just not because they're hiding anything in particular, but just because they don't want to have an outsider treading around and asking them a lot of questions, might sort of profess to be concerned about the, you know, will the victims be upset by this, or will it somehow diminish the sense of heroism? You know, my officers went through hell that day, and I don't want anyone asking questions about them.
Right.
I think that's the attitude.
Well, where would the impetus come from? I mean, if there were to be calls for review, I mean, the FBI assumed overall control of the manhunt after the bombing. So is this a federal probe? Should the mayor of Boston direct this? Governor Deval Patrick? I mean, where do you think authority resides?
I think the governor should. Yes, the governor should. And I think that it should also be done in cooperation with the mayor, because it was a major Boston event. And having those people ordering up and overseeing a kind of blue ribbon panel style investigation also makes the implementation so much easier, so that when the recommendations come through, like we saw with this Kennedy School, the Kennedy School report is full of recommendations. It was not critical to any great extent of the people involved, but it came up with some really good, helpful recommendations. I think there needs to be an implementation of some of those recommendations, but also an investigation so people can come up with their own recommendations and then go about implementing them.
Listeners, we're talking about questions 1 year after the Boston Marathon attacks. What still puzzles you? Do you think we have all the information that we need to have to understand what happened? We're looking at unanswered questions. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we are talking to Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and Janet Reitman, contributor to Rolling Stone magazine. Let's talk about what the FBI knew and whether they missed clues about who Tamerlan Tsarnaev was and about his movements. Two recent reports, as we know, they've gotten a lot of attention lately. One from the House Committee on Homeland Security, another released yesterday by the Inspectors General, point to lapses in intelligence that could have raised, might have raised flags around Tamerlan Tsarnaev in the 2 years leading up to the attack. Now, at issue here, the Russians warned the FBI that Tamerlan was, quote, a follower of radical Islam and that he had changed drastically as he prepared to travel to Russia in 2011. The FBI interviewed him, but then pretty much let him drop out of sight. So for this part of the conversation, I want to welcome Carrie Cordero to Radio Boston. She's director of national security studies at Georgetown University's Law Center. She worked on national security policy and operations for the Department of Justice from 2000 to 2010. And Carrie Cordero, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So you spent a decade working on counterterrorism investigations for the Justice Department. I'm wondering what questions are still unanswered for you about this.
Well, so it's interesting. So you mentioned the House Homeland Security Committee released a report, and then the Offices of Inspector General released a report. And taking a look at those reports, the Inspector General report having just come out yesterday, so that was sort of a quick look. But there does seem to me to be at least perhaps two factual questions that are still out there. Yeah. One is, did the Russians know that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was in Russia in 2012? So, for example, so we know that the FBI conducted a threat assessment in 2011 after the Russian intelligence had provided some preliminary information to the FBI. So they did this threat assessment in the first half of 2011. Then they closed it because they didn't find any derogatory information based on their own investigation. But then he traveled to Russia. And according to what we know as far in terms of the U.S. government reports, it doesn't look like the U.S. government and the Russian government communicated with each other about his travel. But that still doesn't answer the question as to whether the Russians, based on his entry into their country, knew that he was there and did any investigation of him or was simply aware of any of his activities while he was there in 2012. So to me, that's one factual question that hasn't been answered. Mm. And a second factual question that hasn't been answered, at least based on the unclassified reports that have been issued by the government so far, is what was the nature and when did the U.S. government find out that he potentially, Tamerlan that is, potentially had some connection to what's been described in one of the reports as a quote-unquote extremist in Canada. I think this link was mentioned in the House Homeland Security report, but there wasn't sort of any details with it, and it's unclear whether or not this potential connection is information that the government has learned only post the attacks of last year. It appears that way, but I think that's another sort of factual question that is outstanding.
Well, let me play a little tape because the FBI has said if they had known more about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, if somehow they had managed to connect more of these dots together, it wouldn't have made a huge difference. But here's Representative Bill Keating of Massachusetts. He was the only Democrat to sign on to the report from the House Committee of Homeland Security. And here he is. Here's what he told us this morning on WBUR.
I'm very troubled by the response of the FBI when they said if we had all the information we now have, we would have done everything the same way. That attitude is something that will lead us to continue not maximizing what we can to prevent these attacks in the future. And I think that that has to change.
So, Carrie, I want to come back to you. 13 years ago after 9/11, we heard about a failure to connect the dots. Is there evidence? Could that have happened here? Or at least is that a question that is fair to raise and to air out here?
I think it's fair to raise, but there's an important point, which is that in this case, to sort of use the dots analogy, it based on the reports that we have so far, it really doesn't look like the FBI had all of the dots, so to speak. So it really does look, particularly from reading the Homeland Security Committee report, that perhaps there was information that the Russians had based on at least their encountering of Tamerlan Tsarnaev prior to early 2011, it looks like perhaps they had more information than they communicated to the FBI or any other U.S. government agencies. The information, it looks, that they provided to the U.S. government was fairly summary in nature. And once the FBI closed its threat assessment in the summer of 2011, the FBI then sent two more requests to the Russian Intelligence Service asking for more information. And reading between the lines of these reports, and again, I'm only looking at the same public reports that everybody else is looking at, it does look like perhaps the Russians had more information that was not communicated in full to the U.S. government.
Mm. So, Peter, what do you make of that? Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually had a question for Carrie in this thing. The one thing that I made of a lot of these reports is it seemed to me that both the Russians and the FBI perceived the Tsarnaevs as a potential threat to Russia. You know, that would explain why Russia may have had some more information, like they had intercepted a phone call where he discussed jihad with his mother. Tamerlan Tsarnaev discussed jihad with his mother and didn't apparently share that with the FBI. And the fact that the FBI was not aggressive about alerting local law enforcement and really hunting these things down, it seemed more like, you know, people were afraid that he would go to Russia and commit some kind of a crime, and that the FBI was helping the Russians with their own problem rather than vice versa.
That certainly does, you know, based on the reports, that certainly does look like the way the investigation was sort of initiated. And another thing that is worth mentioning is, so Tamerlan and his brother Zahar were U.S. persons, as we would consider them under the law. So Tamerlan was originally a resident alien, which under sort of investigative guidelines is the same as being an American for the way that they're treated under the investigative guidelines and under the law. And so really there are sort of quite a bit of rules and procedures that the FBI has to go through in order to conduct what we might consider a more extensive investigation of someone who has all of the rights of an American under our laws and procedures. And so the investigation that they conducted in the first half of 2011 is what's called a threat assessment, which is the very, very basic level of investigation. And that's what they are supposed to do under their guidelines. They're supposed to do what's called start with the quote-unquote least intrusive means, which means that they're supposed to sort of start at the beginning and conduct an initial investigation, and only if they come up with more facts indicating that this person is a threat to the United States are they then supposed to conduct a more extensive investigation. And so what it appears that the FBI is saying in this case is that there just wasn't anything else that came up in the course of their own investigation, coupled with the very summary information that they were giving from the Russians to indicate that he was a threat.
Mm. Let's take some calls. We've got a bunch of listeners on the lines that want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Brighton with a question. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing? So here's what I want to know. I want to know what the FBI knew and when they knew it. And here's why I say this. First of all, in my eyes, based on living here for the last 25 years, the FBI has a lack of credibility when it comes to the truth, to be perfectly honest with you. And the only reason I say that, of course, is James Whitey Bulger. At any rate, the defense attorneys for the brother who's still alive have been hinting that they tried turning the older brother into an informant. Is that true? I'd like to have the FBI under oath. They want to do it in secret to Congress, fine by me. But the arrogance of the FBI, they haven't even done that. The investigation down in Florida, but the person who was involved, you know, they didn't even testify. They gave a statement.
All right, Dan, we got your point. I just want to say one thing about sort of equating the current FBI office in Boston and sort of bringing up Whitey Bulger. It is a different crew over there now. However, your point is well taken, and let me just turn this question to Janet. Janet, Dan was there talking about, among other things, Tamerlan's, Tsarnaev's relationship with the FBI. What do we know about that? Whether he was approached by the FBI, and if so, why?
Well, I mean, you know, according to Zahar's lawyer, he was. And, you know, that we don't know. We certainly know he was visited by the FBI. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me because This is, you know, in some ways par for the course in a lot of communities. As you know, you could see this in New York, New Jersey. There were some issues with the FBI actually, you know, going into mosques and surveilling Muslims, essentially, in their communities, and that is no longer something they can do. So how are they going to find information about what's going on in communities of interest, so to speak? They're going to have to find people to work with them. And so it wouldn't surprise me that they would have approached him. He was a practicing Muslim. He was going to the mosque. You know, he was, I don't necessarily know if they would have, I'm not sure to what degree the FBI connected to the Chechen issue, to the Chechnya issue. Although if they did, that would make sense that they would not see him as a threat to the United States because the Chechens' enemy really is Russia. But so we don't know. I mean, I just that wouldn't surprise me. But I think to get to your caller's larger question is, if there is an arrogance of the FBI, we don't know a lot about the FBI. We for example, we don't know how Jahar was interrogated. Another point that his lawyers have made and made very early was whether he was actually physically able to make the confession that he supposedly made.
Mm-hmm.
He had just come out of surgery. He had been, by this point, he was shot numerous times, including in the throat, right? He had surgery. He was barely conscious.
Yeah.
And
Janet, I'm going to stop you right there because we need to take a break, but we're going to come back and continue this conversation with Janet Reitman, contributor to Rolling Stone magazine, Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and Carrie Cordero, director of National Security Studies at Georgetown University's Law Center. Listeners, we're talking about what questions remain 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombing. What still puzzles you? What do you want answers to? You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about unanswered questions 1 year after the Boston Marathon attacks. Listeners, what's your question 1 year later? What still puzzles you? Do you think we have all the information that we should? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Peter Canellos, Janet Reitman, and Carrie Cordero. Peter, let me just come back to you and pick up where Dan from Brighton. He called and raised the question about the sort of overall issue of credibility when it comes to the FBI in this context. And of course, there's history in this city. But I'd like you to speak to that issue. I mean, what questions does Dan's question sort of raise in your mind or prompts you to think about in this regard?
Well, it prompted me to think mostly about the Todashev shooting down in Florida, where the FBI did not cooperate with local law enforcement investigations. This is a common practice for the FBI, and it's somewhat understandable. They don't want their agents to be investigated by local law enforcement officials. On the other hand, if they're going to take that position, the FBI needs to have a much more transparent and a much more credible and above board form of investigating itself.
Yeah, right. Carrie Cordero, I'd like to pick up that question with you. I mean, the FBI has sort of accumulated a bit of a reputation over a long period of time as sort of doing their own thing, not being particularly transparent. There are good reasons for that, but it also raises a set of issues that need to be examined as well, right?
Well, sure. And the issue of transparency is sort of, you know, very writ large across the entire national security community right now. So, you know, it is notable that we're having this discussion a year after Boston, when what's happened in the interim has been sort of the whole NSA disclosure issues that have come up. And so, you know, we now have a new FBI director who took the helm this fall, and we have a completely sort of new environment with respect to expectation by the public regarding transparency and national security activity. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think that from this point and going forward, it will take, you know, months and years to sort of make some transition in this area. But I think generally it's not unreasonable to think that we will see a little more transparency from not just the FBI, but the intelligence community and the national security apparatus more broadly.
Let's take a couple more calls. Arlene is calling from Watertown. Arlene, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for taking my call. So I was in Watertown the day after when the bombing, when all of the manhunt was going on for the suspect. And I really felt that the whole situation with the lockdown, the amount of firepower that I saw on the news, and what I heard from my friends who lived on the streets where the shootouts took place, it all seemed way out of proportion with chasing down a single teenage, albeit really, really misguided young man.
And potentially very well armed. But Arlene, I take your point, and I want to put your point to our panel. Peter Canellis, there's a question on Twitter which sort of echoes what our caller just said. Trevor Maloney wonders, was the lockdown and search of homes legal? Can you give consent if the people asking for it are armed on your doorstep? But speak to Arlene's question and what that raises in your mind.
Well, I think it's a tough call on the extent of the lockdown. Obviously, having some degree of lockdown in Watertown and contiguous communities when you knew that there was a suspect on the loose in Watertown makes sense. Whether that had to include all of Boston is a more debatable notion. Now, the argument to keep in mind is that they also did that because it minimized the amount of work that police officers would have to do in their everyday course of business, which enabled them to concentrate on Watertown and on searching for Zahar Tsarnaev. But then you get into the questions that we had before, which is that it took them a long time to find Zahar, and were they, you know, maximizing their resources in the appropriate way? I don't know. You know, this is one where ultimately it was successful in that nobody else was shot after that MBTA mm-hmm. police officer, and they ended up getting the suspect. So I would be inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to the governor who made that call. But it's fodder for discussion and investigation for sure.
Sure. Let's go to John, who's calling from Melrose. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hey, guys, thank you. To get back to Todeshev in Florida being questioned, the FBI and some state troopers were down there. Why didn't they have cameras for their own benefit so they could verify what happened? Mm-hmm. They say they had a confession to the marijuana murders in Waltham, and apparently they were trying to make him sign it under duress, and he obviously attacked them.
Interesting. And from my understanding, at one point the interview was being videotaped and then it wasn't. But who wants to take that on? Carrie Cordero, can you respond to John's question?
You know what? I have not followed the Florida angle as much.
Okay. How about you, Janet?
I'm not actually aware of whether it was videotaped and not, but what I can say is that the FBI is not, unlike other forms of law enforcement, local law enforcement, they're not required to videotape any interviews or use any kind of recording devices. So it's kind of that's actually a big problem with many many cases, and I think a lot with this case in terms of the kinds of interviews that they've done, because you kind of have to take their word for it. And this is a perfect example of where the system just doesn't work. And this has been a real problem in a civil liberties issue, because you have, you know, many other cases in which the FBI has done interviews with suspects, and you basically had to take the word of the agent. I know from my own reporting that in the Tsarnaev case, you know, they fanned out across the country and even into Canada to find anyone who knew Zahar Tsarnaev. Mostly these were high school friends. And they interviewed all these kids without lawyers. These were, you know, maybe 19 years old at the time, maybe 20. So they were adults, but they're adolescents, and they didn't know they were supposed to have a lawyer. They were entitled to a lawyer. They felt threatened. In certain cases, they went back and reinterviewed kids many times. And one kid finally confessed, and he's facing a number of years in prison for, you know, taking part. I can't even now think of the exact charge. It was, you know, sort of it was actually lying to a federal officer. Because he initially, this is one of the very close friends from high school that went to college with him, and then came back early and he was he just happened to be up at college during this weekend that this happened, and when the officers went and questioned him, he was involved in perhaps disposing of the backpack. And when the officers went to question him, he lied. And he ultimately, after three or four times with the FBI, confessed that he had lied. So now he's facing a number of years in jail. But we don't know how aggressively they interviewed him, what techniques were used, whether this was coerced. Similarly, we don't know how Jahar was interviewed, you know, how much he actually confessed to, whether any of this was elicited from him. And we certainly don't know how Todashev was interviewed. And this is because the FBI is not required to videotape anything. And, we, you know, it is, to me, in my view, you know, it's the supreme level of arrogance where, you know, you basically have to trust this federal agency that hasn't done a terrific job.
So big question there. We're just about out of time, but I want to leave all of you with one question. Representative Keating spoke to this point on Morning Edition earlier today, and he said this: we will never know, looking backwards, if this could have been prevented. That question will haunt us going forward. What's really important for us to focus on is to make changes and to learn where there were red flags and gaps in the system. Carrie Cordero, I'll end with you here. Do you think that this story will bring about changes that could prevent something like this from happening again down the road?
Based on the report so far, I know the Homeland Security report makes some recommendations about a little better information sharing, sort of improving the way that information goes into databases, things like that. I have to say I'm somewhat skeptical that those changes, although they may improve processes around the edges, really would have a dramatic effect. I think the big issue in this case seems to be the gap in factual knowledge between what the FBI had, and I'm not sure whether or not that can be rectified by changes to sort of minor procedures and processes.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there with that note of skepticism and questions, which is where we started. Carrie Cordero, Director of National Security Studies at Georgetown University's Law Center, thank you.
Thank you.
And Janet Reitman, Contributing Editor to Rolling Stone Magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
And Peter Kanellis, as always, Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony.
And listeners, stay with us. More ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.